Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is author and senior editor at the Linux Journal, Doc Searles. Doc, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
I have been following your career all of my career. I've been aware of you as editor of Linux Journal, which I used to subscribe to, and the Cloutrain Manifesto. You are a co-author, a book that sort of just sent tremors out through the community, and we all loved it. So it's delightful to have you on the show. And I wanted to ask you about all these things that you've been doing in your career and your expertise. But I want to start first with, as we do on Background Mode, ask you about the earliest part of your career and how all this great stuff got started. You started your career as a reporter and photographer for a small paper. But even before that, were you thinking about becoming a reporter, and did that drag you into technology? How did that work?
I always loved to write, but I was sent on a writing path by the only teacher who ever thought I was good at anything, because I was a terrible student. I was a junior in high school who told me he thought I could write, and that energized me. So I had thoughts at that time of being a journalist, and I did poorly in college, too, for the most part. And when I got out, I was fighting the draft. That was 1969. So in those days, one was draft eligible if one was male coming out of college. Right. So, and I ricocheted around some other jobs in retail and driving a forklift at a Hunts Point Market in the Bronx, driving an ice cream truck, other things like that. But I got the newspaper job, and it kind of set me on a path, but I also worked in radio. I worked in a zillion other things along the way too. So, but journalism has always been a big part of what I'm about. So that's kind of the main thread.
You know, it's interesting. You said that there was a teacher who believed in you and thought you were a great writer. That can have a great influence on people. I mean, if somebody who says overtly they believe in you and they love your stuff, that could launch a whole career.
Yeah, I'm not so sure he believed in me. He just said that was good. Mm-hmm. And that had never been said to me, I think, from kindergarten until I was 16 years old at the time. And I had a roommate who was a much better writer, a really fabulous writer. He's now the retired Bishop of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in the Anglican Church, taught at Yale and other things. He was a real achiever and very, very funny. And I kind of acquired some of his sense of humor along the way, because a big part of what I've done in my life is tell jokes, too. I mean, so, you know, it's just a complicated path.
You mentioned in your bio that you worked for a small radio station as an engineer, as a disc jockey, as a reporter, advertising salesman. That sounds like a very small radio station with a very large to-do list.
More than one. It was Sidley. There were three of them, come to think of it. One was in New Jersey, WSUS in Sussex County. I would climb the tower to change bulbs and tune up the transmitter. I was a ham radio operator when I was young. So I knew a little bit of, you know, the broadcast engineering stuff. That was probably my earliest technical background. A joke about myself is that the only code I know is Morse, which is completely useless.
But I know so many people who were ham people who, when the Apple II came out, they just leaped all over it because they saw the prospects.
I wanted one of those so bad, but I didn't have the money for that. They weren't cheap. I mean, a couple grand, you know, before you even buy the programs, and the programs are like, you know, $100 to $300, something like that, in 1977, 78. I had two young kids at the time, and I was, you know, trying to make a business go. I couldn't afford it, but I did pick up, our company picked up the very first 128K Mac, and when it came out in 1984, we bought one of the first ones in North Carolina, and that changed our lives. It really did. I mean, it was the first useful computer we'd ever used, and I've been using Macs ever since.
Back to the radio station, is that where you got the name Doc?
Yeah, that was at a station, a commercial station that was owned by Duke University, and I was selling advertising for them, among other things, but it was very hard. It was a really small station, and in that part of the world, stations came in two sizes, tiny and enormous, and we were one of the tiny ones and really couldn't compete for advertising very well. So we, I made up ads for things that didn't exist, and had a bunch of characters that I did.
Did people know what you were doing as sort of a wry smile, or were they upset?
Because the same guy's voice was on all these ads, and because I started writing joke columns for, like, we had a monthly arts magazine too, and so I wrote in that. Somebody else named me Dr. Dave, and my real name is David. And what happened there was that two of my listeners, realizing that I could write, said, you know, approached me and said, let's start an ad agency, and you could be a creative director and write copy. And I said, sure, because at that time I was leaving the station. The station was being sold, or at least there were rumors of it. It was complicated. But it was really great to have, like, a full-time steady job. But one of the two guys was named David, and he was very possessive of the name. And so they just called me Dr. Dave, and that shortened down to Doc. And it stuck ever since.
Cool.
And I'm not a real doctor. I think most people call Doc, like, the gunslinger and the dwarf and the, all the musicians named Doc
Severinsen, right?
Doc Severinsen, the basketball coach, you know, for the Clippers.
Right.
None of them are doctors. it's a nickname that shows up. It's one of those, like, Buzz.
Were you studying Linux at this point on the time? Because soon thereafter, you landed a job at the Linux Journal.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I never studied Linux, really. What happened was, a friend of mine was going to start a free software magazine. Richard M. Stallman came up with the idea of free software back in the 80s. That's free as in freedom, not as in cost. And then this guy, his name is Phil Hughes, ran across Linus Torvalds. He ran across what he was doing with Linux and did a quick pivot and said, we're going to start this magazine about Linux. And nobody knew Linux at that time. So that came out in 1994, right when Linux hit 1.0. And so I sort of advised him on the start of it, but I started writing for it in 86. So I've been writing for Linux Journal one way or another for 21 years. But everything I write is pretty high level and not technical. There are lots of technical writers for the publication. And I'm the guy who's looking at the big picture. But I had a lot to do with, you know, for example, the decision to really push open source rather than free software. A lot of people may not know that the term open source was hardly used before February of 1998. That's when a bunch of geeks decided the world would rather talk about open source than free software. And since then, it's taken on a life of its own. So,
I was at the Oak Ridge National Lab in those days, and we were very aware of what you and Stallman were doing.
Yeah, well, an interesting thing is that the term open source was well understood within military and high science places, but not in the general geek population. So if you look it up on, say, Google's Ngrams server, which a search engine which looks through books through the from 1800 forward, you'll see there's sort of a residual level of the phrase being used, and then it hockey sticks in 1998. And that's because a bunch of geeks decided we're going to talk about it.
Did that naturally lead to the collaboration with Levine, Locke, and Weinberger about thinking about the Clutrain Manifesto? Did that naturally lead into that, or was that
a little bit? I think what brought the four of us together was that we discovered, some of us knew each other. I knew Chris Locke, Chris knew Rick and David. Rick and Chris were both in Boulder. David was in Boston. I was in the Bay Area, and we were kindred souls in the sense that we were very mindful and, you know, talked all the time with people about how, wait a minute, that the best thing that ever happened to civilization is right under us. It's called the internet. This changes everything. We are now on a brand new footing, and we can do anything with this. And what are we doing? We're making malls, and we're making retail operations, and we're building more silos. When here we have something that was designed to empower everybody, to give everybody an Archimedean place to stand and move the world, and we're just, you know, doing stuff that we thought just took no imagination whatsoever and in fact set us back. And so we decided, you know, we just talked on the phone a lot and then decided, hey, let's just put something up on the web. And I mean, it was a rant. I mean, the Clue Train Manifesto was, you know, we called it a manifesto because that worked for Marx, and we called it, and we had 95 theses because that worked for Luther. Clue Train is based on an old Silicon Valley epitaph that was uttered at that time about Apple, believe it or not, that said the Clue Train stopped there 4 times a day for 10 years and they never took delivery.
I remember that now.
At that time, Dave Weiner likes to say that in Silicon Valley, there's always, you know, somebody is dead, somebody is the future, and somebody rules. And at that time, Microsoft ruled, Java was the future, and Apple was dead.
Right.
So now it's like blockchain is the future, you know, Apple rules, and I don't know who's dead. You know, somebody's got to be dead. But I mean, it's kind of an insightful thing. Yeah.
Maybe. That website and the Clue Train Manifesto turned into a book in 2000. For those one or two listeners who may not be familiar with what the thesis was of that book, describe that central manifesto for us.
Well, it's the original subtitle of the book was The End of Business as Usual. And the point there was that business as usual was what the internet was supposed to kill off. And so that was the idea behind that. But the thing that galvanized us, the encapsulating line, and it came from Chris Locke, and he actually sent it to the rest of us by email, and it was a little GIF, a little GIF file that's in the manifesto, and it says above it, if there's one clue to get this year, which was 1999, 18 years ago, this is it. And then the graphic said, we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it. And it's funny because that is rarely quoted. I think the reason is you can't copy and paste it. And I think another reason is it's not among the 95. The first one in the 95 is the one that gets quoted the most, and that's one of mine. It says, markets are conversations.
I remember that.
And my point about that is that markets are bazaars. Ideally, they're a bazaar. And bazaars are all conversation. And that's what the internet supported. Now, at the same time, Eric S. Raymond, who was the primary promulgator of the open source meme, you might say, and the whole idea of open source, and was just brilliant with it, was coming out with a book and did come out with a book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. And that contrasted two approaches to developing software, the cathedral approach, which is closed, and the bazaar approach, which is inherently open and everybody can participate in. And I saw, well, we all saw, the four of us saw the market as fundamentally a wide open place where everybody has power. Everybody has a place to stand. Everybody can participate, and the internet supporting that. There was another one that David Weinberger wrote that said hyperlinks subvert hierarchy, and there were a bunch about voice, and that, you know, the natural voice of the individual is the voice of the internet. And I think implicit in that is also the simple fact that every one of us is different. We all sound different. We all look different. And that's a design feature of the human species. There are other species where everyone looks the same, but smells different, right? But, and members of that species tell each other apart by, say, smell or something else, but pheromones. But human beings are inherently different. And they're not only different from each other, but they're different from who they were 5 minutes ago. So all of that's, you know, that was all kind of implicit in that as well. And we wanted to get respect for that. An irony of Clutrain is that it really appealed most to marketers, and it was exactly marketers that we were yelling at. So, yeah, it's sort of an interesting thing. It's still playing out. I mean,
it is.
You could go to Twitter and do a lookup on Clutrain, and it tends to get mentioned some number of times per day. It's pretty amazing, actually.
Well, it's time to take a break. This is a good point. When we come back, I want to ask you about how that contrasts to what Apple had been thinking with Steve Jobs and a couple other technical issues and some of your books. We'll get to all of that when we come back. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO, or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. I am chatting with Doc Searles. So I want to ask you about what we were talking about with the Clutrain and Apple's historical sort of walled garden and approach to design, you know, the celebration of Jonathan Ive, Steve Jobs' feeling about how you don't know what you need until we give it to you. And for years and years, Apple was handing us things that were glorious that we didn't know we needed, we loved. And then all of a sudden in 2016, maybe even earlier, there seemed to be this pause in the action. And the iPads were not coming out regularly. The Macs were not coming out regularly. And all of a sudden, this conversation, this bazaar started where everybody was talking about what's Apple up to, what's happening, when are we going to get new products. Comment on that for us. How do you feel about what's happening there?
I see several things, you know. One is that Apple is the product, especially since Steve came back, of possibly the greatest genius in the history of business. I mean, Steve was one of a kind. I mean, I think that, like, there's never been another Shakespeare. There never was and never will be another Steve Jobs. And I don't mean that to just flatter the dude. I think he really was one of those. I mean, he violated so many conventions of business. And I mean, he could actually tell the entire, all of Wall Street, I don't care what you think, and you're going to value what we're doing anyway. And he was so original and driven. I just have huge respect for that, but he's not replaceable. And I think we can date that pause you spoke about to the death of Steve Jobs in 2011, in the fall of 2011. The things that were in the pipeline came out. I'm sure Steve knew about the watch and the Pro and a few other things like that. It obviously had a lot to do with the building. The last public appearance he made was in front of the Cupertino City Council to pitch for the, for the building. They could hardly say no. I'm not so sure you cut off the head and the body dies. And I don't know. I mean, obviously Ive is a great guy. I mean, and really original. I think possibly next to Steve, the most important person in the history of Apple is actually, Ron Johnson with the stores. The stores were a real break away from what Steve would have done. Steve didn't care about customers, really. He was Picasso. He wanted you to admire his art. He was an artist. That made him so distinctive. There was nobody else like that. Everybody else will do design as kind of an afterthought. Yeah, we have to put a design on here. It was like Detroit. It has to look different this year than it looked last year. Steve was so original about that. But he really didn't care about customers very much. And one reason they started the stores is that they really didn't treat the channel very well. The channel didn't know what to do with them. And he really wanted, you know, to go straight through to the customer. But I think, if I recall the Isaacson biography, which I'm staring at on, in a bookshelf over here, it was really Ron Johnson who said, put the genius bar in the back, hire these people that know all about your stuff, get intelligence from that. Mm-hmm. And so the heuristics of Apple are just clean the clock of everybody else. I mean, with a Dell, you can't bring that into a store. Microsoft was totally caught up in just simply supplying, you know, they were two tiers away. They licensed that operating system to OEMs. They had a lot of control over their OEMs, but now they've adopted Apple's approach where they're making the hardware as well. And I should add, making stuff that's far more original than what Apple's coming out with right now.
There's been a discussion about that conversation about the Surface tablet.
They're really swell and hats off to them. And, but in the meantime, you know, I think Apple learns a lot that way. I've brought in any number of machines where some new thing has gone wrong and the person behind the counter has said, yeah, we haven't seen that before. I said, what happens to that? Well, it goes back to headquarters. It's part of how they learn. That is incredibly important. And I think all of us know that you don't want to buy the next MacBook Pro or the next iPhone. You know, I don't want to buy the iPhone 8 on September 30th. I want to buy it in December, you know, after it's gone through a couple of iterations. They do that. You know, they after they come out. And that has a lot to do with...
We're kind of stuck as writers, though, because if we're going to write about it, we have to have one. So we're the bleeding edge.
They would be very good. But that said, at the same time, Apple's closeness, its secrecy, I mean, name an Apple blogger, okay? They don't exist because it's too dangerous. You just can't do that. And there have been a few from time to time, but they're not there. Apple's not involved in conversations out in the world very much. They are with some things where they're playing a long game, like with health. I think Apple Health is possibly the most important thing they're doing right now. But it's a very long game. I think they're trying to fix healthcare. Yeah. They're trying to fix health research. They've dealt with really knowledgeable outsiders and collaborated with them on that, from what I understand. I think it's really wonderful what they're doing with privacy. They are among what in Europe they call GAFA. GAFA stands for Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. They're the only one of those four that really fully respects the privacy of the individual. I think most people don't know that your fingerprint is known to the machine. It's not known to Apple. This doesn't go to the cloud. And Apple doesn't want to know what's on your machine. They made what
right.
I thought.
They keep it in the secure enclave, a special secure hardware location on the iPhone.
Right. And they made a really principled stand by not helping the FBI hack into one of their phones. They respect the sovereignty and privacy of the individual, which to me is one of the most important things any company can do on the net right now, because we still don't have privacy that's native. I mean, we took us 10,000 years to work out privacy in the physical world, and we have clothing and shelter. Those are privacy technologies. There's no such thing on the open internet. We don't have clothing. We don't have shelter. We should have had it with browsers, but browsers were, you know, the web, unfortunately, we chose client server as a way to do that. And client server might as well be called slave master. So all of the resources are centrally located. And it, in essence, it really violates the spirit, if not the letter, of the way the net was designed. So we don't have privacy. And Apple respects that. That's just a great thing.
As long as Apple does that, we'll be customers and loyal to them because of the stand that they take.
That helps. And I think that's a Tim Cook thing. I think because he's a very private guy, and you get that. You know, I mean, Steve was private too, but he was a bit of an extrovert, you know, and I don't think that was one of the things he cared very deeply about, but or just wasn't a big thing for him. But it really is for Tim. You really get that. And I think that's part of what he brings to the ethos of Apple. But my concern for them, though, is that they, by being as isolated as they are, they're making some bad decisions. And I have to say, too, that what they did with the trackpad, what they did with that, whatever that is, that slider thing and
touch
the,
bar.
In the back, the
touch bar.
MagSafe. I mean, I was ready to buy an iPhone 7 and a new MacBook. I'm talking to you over 2013 generation Air. I love the MagSafe connector. They got rid of that. They didn't need to. They really didn't. It didn't take up that much room. It seemed like a really passive aggressive.
Well, you know, having four USB-C ports on a machine and eliminating all those other ports, you're right. People have had some thoughts about that aren't very favorable.
Well, you know, it may play out in the long run, but I think it was a real, mistake on their part.
And I like your term passive aggressive. That's cute.
Yeah.
Before the show, we were chatting and you mentioned that you had driven by Apple Park, the mothership, recently and had some thoughts about what that building means to Apple. We've spoken very positively about Apple, but you had some interesting thoughts about what that building might imply.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought a couple things about it. The first was a common, if not sure, sign of a terminal condition for a giant company that's full of itself is that it makes a landmark and puts its name on it. And we've seen this with so many names on ballparks, 3Com Park, Enron Park. You know, there's I'm concerned about Salesforce building the biggest building in San Francisco right now. There's a tendency that companies have to do that. And it is an impressive building. It's not done at all. It's that curvedness of it means you can't see an edge. You don't see where it ends. And is a visual trick with you, but making it look much more gigantic than it really is. You look at it from above and you say, oh, it's a city block.
Size of the Pentagon.
Yeah. I mean, Pentagon, I suppose, is a city block too, but you get in, you know, you look at the edge of it and it's like, wow, that is just scary, large and different. At the same time, another thought that I had was, well, why isn't Steve's grave in the middle of this thing? This is his pyramid right here. You know, I mean, that's Pharaoh Steve ought to be in this thing. You know,
one of the questions I have is unanswered is whether Steve's old office at Infinite Loop was packed up and reconstructed at Apple Park. I haven't heard a story about that yet.
No, oh, really?
I'm still researching.
I know that the way they designed it was that it was supposed to be relatively open, you know, somewhat egalitarian, you know, with a lot of windows and, you know, except for partitions between parts of the company that aren't supposed to know what other parts of the company are doing. It would be walled off, and I don't know how they do that, but I seem to recall actually Stephen Levy's piece that was somewhere a few days ago.
Yeah, that was Wired. Yeah.
Yeah. Wired talked about that. He'd be the one to give the authoritative response on this. He'd be good to talk to you just anyway.
I think I might do that. So back to Steve Jobs. I think it was about the time that Steve Jobs came back to Apple. You wrote an article called Stock Searles on Steve Jobs. I had a note to chat, ask you about that.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is it was in 1997. It was not long after Steve came back, and he didn't waste much time getting rid of the clones. And, you know, in that time in history, or a little earlier, the assumption was that Microsoft's approach was the right one, and what you needed is to make the software and have hardware makers compete for making the best hardware. And so Apple had made a foray into that. They really didn't do a great job of it. All those cloners were much more controlled than Microsoft's were. But there were at least, I know there's one of them in Milpitas. There were a few more, I think, but what matters is that Steve shot him in the head immediately. And And it was a kind of a great hue and cry. And Dave Winer wrote something about it. And Dave's a good friend and one of the authors of the world. He wrote Think Tank and More, which were landmark Mac applications back in the 80s, and later invented RSS and podcasting in many ways and blogging. But back in the back then, he had a blog basically known as DaveNet. And I wrote him I was on an airplane actually, and I wrote to him something saying, no, Steve, this is very characteristic of Steve. Steve's an artist. He wants you to admire his art. Artists don't have clones. Okay. And then I had a list of five or six things that I was sure Apple would do, and they did all those things. And so, so it was regarded as somebody's prophecy. I did not expect him to publish that email, but he did immediately. He just took it and didn't even ask. He just published it. And as Doc Searles on Steve Jobs. And if you look it up, Doc Searles on Steve Jobs, it'll come up in the top of a search. For a while, it was one of the most found things if you searched for Steve Jobs. It wasn't back at Apple for very long. And later I ran into Andy Hertzfeld for the first time, and he recognized my name, and he said, that thing you wrote about Steve really nailed it. And I didn't think it was that insightful, honestly. I thought everybody should know he's an artist. But
Steve liked it.
Nobody expected CEOs to be artists, you know, but he was. Yeah, he really was.
He really was. We were talking about Internet's privacy a little while ago. I want to get back to your thoughts on Internet security. You know, we've heard about some really high profile assaults on the internet, ransomware recently, and the Handbrake incident that caught Panic Software by surprise. How are you feeling about the current state of security and these assaults that we hear about daily? Do you think there's hope for the internet that we can solve this problem in the future, or what's going to happen?
Sure. I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of faith, actually. Let's just start with recognizing that internet security is an oxymoron. There's no such thing. It's like, what's gravity security? You know, it's just there. You can use the internet for nature security. There's no security in nature. You have to add it, right? And the thing is, if all you have are both giant companies and really single ways of doing anything, you've got a monoculture, and monocultures are very easy to exploit. I think with this latest one, there were Windows XP vulnerabilities out there that were exploited. And, it's certainly not the first of those, and it won't be the last. To me, the ultimate security is the kind that we have personally. And for that, we really need to be in full control of our machines and our software and our data. And we need to be sovereign and secure individuals on the net. And while perfect security is not possible for anything, individuals are a much smaller target than a big company or a big operating system or a widely spread anything.
That's true.
The internet was designed to give all of us, like I said earlier, a separate place to stand where we can, you know, we can wear our own clothes. We can put up our own doors and windows and shutters. And we need to start thinking about that. I think the most important thinking around right now is, you see it with blockchain, for example, is how do we distribute power on the net? How do we distribute agreements? How do we distribute our financial system, our educational system, anything that's systematic at all, identity, in ways where no one company controls it and can be attacked, or just slow down innovation because, well, geez, Facebook's there, we can't fight them, or Google's there, we can't fight them, we can't make them do what we want. I think that, you know, the answer to that is to empower individuals, which, by the way, is what we were calling for in Clutrain in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I've written about, you know, all my life. So
do you think artificial intelligence plays a role in this?
If we have it for ourselves, I want an AI for my own purposes.
As a partner to help you assist you in securing your system?
Yeah, I mean, every new tech that comes along comes with two assumptions that are, or three, that never fail. One is, it's the future, you know. Oh, Right. Sure. Machine learning is the future. The second is it's a terrible threat. It's going to put people out of jobs, you know, and,
right.
And the third is that, you know what, how, when it succeeds, here's how individuals will do more with it than any of these companies could do. We saw it with personal computing. I mean, you know, if it's 1982, personal computers have been around since, what, 76, 77? That's mm-hmm. when the Apple came along. IBM comes out with the PC. They certify that personal computer is what these things are going to be called. They put the IBM logo on it and make it okay to bring them into companies. But if you were an MIS director, there were no IT directors back then, no CIOs or CTOs. They were just MIS directors. And if you're an MIS director, you're saying, I'm not going to let any PCs in here. And then 2 years later, you can't get away from them. And the reason is not because PCs were great, but rather because people, individuals, could do more with them than the company could. That's going to be the case with AI.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, we only have another minute or two left. I wanted to close with a question about your latest project. You've got a new book coming out called The Giant Zero. Here's your chance. I want to hear about
that. That's the book I've put off a lot on that. If you look up The Giant Zero in my name, you'll see what I've written about it so far. The book I'm working on right now is called The Biggest Boycott, People versus Advertising. And it's about ad blocking and tracking protection and and what the next steps are after that, ad blocking to me is one of the most empowering things ever, and it is remarkably stupid of publishers and advertisers and everybody on the supply side of that market to think that ad blocking is a threat at all. It's a great message from the marketplace. It's pure Clutrain.
Is that a book coming out soon?
I don't know, probably early next year. I mean, I haven't sold it yet. I know the likely buyers. David Weinberger is helping me with it informally so far. The hard thing with it is that the story changes all the time. I just know how it ends, which is that tracking-based advertising online will get blown up. It's going to be over.
I can't wait to hear more about that. Cool. Well, we are out of time now, so I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a fascinating discussion from an expert, and I enjoyed very much hearing your views on all the things we talked about, so it was great. Thank you.
And thanks so much for having me. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Oh, boy. Just my first name at my last name, or my nickname at my last name, but I'm at D. Searles on Twitter.
Oh, okay. That's very good. We'll use that one on the show notes. All right. Well, again, thank you much for being on the show. And listeners, thank you for coming by. We always look forward to having you with us, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.